bit late. I'll now call the case 95-2136, Janky versus Clark County. Mr. Hayes, representing the Jankies, will argue for 12 and a half minutes. Mr. Minkowski will argue for 12 and a half minutes. And then we have on the defense side, three people arguing each at 10 minutes. Am I right? Okay. We'll start off with you, Mr. Tays.
If it please the court, my name is Ronald Tays, and I am from the law firm of Previan Goldberg, Almond, Gratz, Miller, and Brueggemann. And we are here today along with Cole Bolson on behalf of Emil Janky, the plaintiff in this action, and his wife, Mary Janky. We are here to argue against the adoption of governmental immunity for independent contractors because it's our position that this type of immunity runs against the basic tenet that individuals, under our system of law, be held accountable for their wrongful conduct. It is our position that governmental immunity is granted pursuant to Section 89380 of the Wisconsin statutes to agents of that governmental entity, and that the first issue then is whether or not that contractor is an agent for the purposes of the statute. This is a statutory construction argument, as was addressed by the court in Kettner. Briefly, the court held there that under Kettner, that agents was an ambiguous term, and so the court then looked at the historical analysis of governmental immunity, plus the legislative history to the statute 89380, as it was, as governmental immunity was originally abrogated in Holtz versus Milwaukee. Kettner limited the agency status to only those contractors that have a master-servant relationship with the government. They used as their basis for that position the basic agency principle of respondeat superior. Of course, a contractor that is an independent contractor, his conduct is not imputable to the government. Therefore, the government is not responsible for the tort or the liability of that contractor. The Lyons case, which obviously will be discussed today, makes no analysis of that statutory interpretation or the legislative history behind governmental immunity or behind the relationship between the government and its contractors.
Now, Kim, I just want to double back for a minute. Something that's bothered me. Clark County had this facility built, right? Is Clark County liable for the windows or the lack of or the negligence for having those windows in that form?
No, I think that the decision that Clark County made to remodel this hospital is a discretionary decision.
If that's discretionary. And then getting the particular windows, that's discretionary too?
Well, I think that the decision that Clark County made to say we want this certain type of therapeutic environment for our patients, and they quantified that by saying we want windows without bars and without security screens, I think those are discretionary decisions as well.
But you're suing them under a safe place doctrine too, aren't you?
Well, there is that claim in the case, Your
Honor. That's right. And the safe place issue relates to the windows, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so if we stay with the decision, then is it possible that the county is going to be liable, but these independent contractors would not be?
Under the safe place theory
yes.
alone?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
and I find that somewhat peculiar.
Under the safe place theory, I would say that it would be possible for the county to be liable under that. But
Your other theory is negligent care of the person.
Right.
And that, of course, does not have anything to do with the contractors and the builders and so on. But under your safe place theory, you do have an issue where you could get the county liable, but the builders not, if this stays the way it is.
If the contractors are granted immunity?
Right. So
that's correct. Although, of course, we would take the position
that
contractors...
they shouldn't. I understand that, but I...
not.
I just found that as somewhat ironic.
To move it one step to the discretionary decisions that were made by the county, we don't take the position that the decisions made by the architect in choosing the windows and in installing and basically making those decisions would be discretionary decisions.
They are not?
Why not?
Well, if I could quote from the case of Sheridan versus Janesville, it says, the distinction, and this, well, excuse me, this is from Gordon v. Milwaukee County. The distinction generally made in the application of the discretionary function exemption is between those decisions which are made on a policy or planning level as opposed to those made on an operational level. And I think in this case, the decision as to the therapeutic environment and to remodel the hospital are certainly planning and policy decisions. But then, and these decisions are made by lay people, but then when the decision goes to what type of window do we pick, and what type of window meets these policy decisions, those are operational decisions made by the people hired by the county, the architects, and the people along that, and the contractor and the window manufacturer are operational decisions which are not discretionary decisions. They don't rise to the level of a policy decision.
Now here is the county each time, going back historically, but when they made the first decision, the type of window we want is a window that is not draconian, that is more modern in style, does not give the thought that this is an institutional type situation look. But the county was making a quote decision, certainly a discretionary decision. It was based on what? It was based on both state and federal law and inspection that said you have to have some windows that will open. And you don't believe that decision there was discretionary?
By the
county?
No, I believe it was discretionary.
Yeah, but I mean, and then they passed that along to the contractor or the architect, I should say, and then they contacted J.P. Cullen, who then contacted Milko. But what you're saying is that was a decision that they made, I'm talking about the contractors, that was different than what the county wanted?
Well, I don't know if it's different than what the county wanted, but I think the decision made by the contractors was different than the one made by the county. The county had told them what they wanted, and whether or not that's a reasonably precise specification might get talked about later. But the county said, basically, we want a window that looks like a window but doesn't operate like a window.
And you're generally saying that, you know, the Lyon case came from Boyle, and Boyle was a federal decision based upon, I guess, the design of a helicopter and how they would design the pilot getting out when it went underwater, and that was a much more technical consideration than putting in these so-called security windows.
Right. But the Boyle decision, and of course we're against the adoption of the Boyle decision through Lyons, but the factual situation in Boyle and Lyons is much different than the factual situation in this case, because in both Boyle and Lyons, you're dealing with a set of engineers for the governmental entity, whether it's the federal government or the DOT in the Lyons case, that are working at an equal level with the private engineers. In the Clark County case, you don't have that. You have professional architects and professional builders who are contracting with a set of lay people as a building review committee that have nowhere near the level of expertise that they have in the other cases. So consequently, there's a large factual difference between what happened in Lyons and Boyle and what happened in the Clark County situation. We would also, Your Honor, moving along, take the position that adopting the Boyle and the Boyle case through the Lyons decision would not be good public policy for the state of Wisconsin. We do not feel that it is fundamentally unfair, as has been argued by some of the defendants in this case, for this Boyle test and Lyons to not be adopted. Our tort system has been not perfect and has, in many circumstances, treated parties differently. Several examples of that be workers' compensation law. The employer may be immune from suit, even though they may have some percentage of fault. In traditional joint and several liability, it's not unusual for tortfeasors to pay a disproportionate share of their responsibility. And in 402A, strict liability, even liabilities imposed on manufacturers in those types of cases, strictly for the due care and the design of the product. The character of the manufacturer's conduct or the condition of the product is not considered. Tort law has always been imperfect in that, and that is based on its fundamental principle that the injured victim should not be the one to bear the loss in this case, and that the risk of injury should be borne by those best able to manage the risk and to guard against its by safeguarding against injury or its cause. The second rationale put forward is the doctrine that judicial...
Are you going to reach the question of the mental capacity of Mr. Gang, or is that some other attorney?
I can reach that capacity. I mean,
My concern is that if we agree with the trial court, that ends this, all the issues, does it not? We agree that Mr. Galecki is held to a reasonable person standard, and that his negligence as a matter of law was greater than the combined negligence of the defendants. We need not even address the general contractor issue, do we?
Well, that would be correct if you agreed that he was more responsible.
Okay, so let me ask you a shorthand question. Why should we extend Gould?
Well, I don't think that we are extending Gould.
Okay.
Gould and Birch both deal primarily with the negligence of mentally incapacitated tortfeasors. And the jury instruction 1021 speaks in terms of the defendants. In this case, Mr. Janke is not the defendant. He is the injured party that has the mental disability. Neither the exception under Gould or the exception under Birch apply in this case. In those cases, mentally disabled people caused injuries to others. If we apply the reasonable standard to Mr. Janke, it's going to be virtually impossible for him to never be more negligent than people that are not adjudged to have a mental problem. Mr. Janke is being held in the Clark County Hospital pursuant to a Chapter 51 proceeding. He's already been adjudged to be a danger to himself or others. He is already found to have a mental disability.
Now, counsel, excuse me, I apologize, Mr. Ron. Go ahead.
To compare him to a reasonable person standard, he is rarely going to come out fairly under that type of a comparison, and it hasn't been required to this point in time. Those cases look towards the defendant, not towards the mental capacity of an injured plaintiff.
Well, why shouldn't we hold him to a reasonable person standard?
He hasn't caused harm to anyone. The two exceptions, Gould and Birch, in Gould, the exception is based upon the fact that the caretaker, the paid caretaker, is not an innocent party when that person is in taking care of the Alzheimer's patient.
Well, when you look at this record, now you're saying, well, it was okay to use it perhaps defensively in the Gould case, but now offensively because your client is the plaintiff here. We'd have to look at, did this prevent him from controlling his actions? And when I read the record and the transcript, he had just been visited by his wife. He'd been there 12 days. He originally came on because he had allegedly assaulted her for a 72-hour hold, and then that was extended into a 5115. Question is that this record seems to indicate that he did a great deal of poor planning. I'm talking about... propping up the pillows so that the inspection every 2 hours would indicate that he was in bed, to selecting the window to jumping down on the roof. It seems to me that he certainly, unless you're going to say we have this broad scope where people who are mentally incapacitated should not be responsible for their acts. And that, I think that's what you're saying. We're not going to extend Gould, but I think the reasonable person standard has been the law of the state of Wisconsin.
Well, it certainly has been for defendants up to this point in time. What we're saying is that it should be a question of fact. This was a summary judgment proceeding
in the lower
court.
To go to the jury. You don't think the court, as a matter of law, could decide that one way or the other?
Under these facts, I don't think so. Dr. Sue, who the psychiatrist in this case, testified that he acts, that because of this bipolar disorder, he acts impulsively, does not understand the ramifications of his acts, and that material is in in the record as well.
Thank you, Mr. Tays. Your time is up. Mr. Minkowski. You represent Clark County.
Good afternoon. I'm Tim Minkowski, with the law firm of Cabela, Carlson, Minkowski & Steeves. Also here with me today is Mary Nelson, who's done an awful lot of the brief writing and has been a great help on the case. Contrary to the plaintiff's view, I believe that governmental contractor immunity is appropriate. I just don't believe it fits the facts that you have before you. It seems to me that there has to be some ultimate design responsibility that the government keeps for itself to create immunity for the contractor. Here Arlen Mills said, I want windows that open, I want no bars, and I don't want security screens. I think that is government discretion where that immunity flows to the contractor. But Arlen Mills, who made those decisions, is an administrator, not a designer of hospitals. And that's where he hires Pamela Green Abramson to do the design. And it seems to me any design function beyond that phase that I've just discussed is now the responsibility of the architect. Because at that point, all the county does is rubber stamp and approve the work. They aren't actively involved in participating in making that decision or issuing directives. So I think it has limited application in that context. But the thing that concerns me the most on this issue, and it hasn't appeared in any other decision in this case, and yet it's been argued, is that the window that was made to follow that specification never met the specification. And that's the problem that we have here. After the accident is the first time people realize that the window doesn't work right. And Milko comes in after the accident and says, we got to change this. When the window slides, there's a cube stop up in the top rack that prevents it from moving. If you pull that stop out, now they got this long channel stock that stops it in the top. But the problem with the window is that it racks in the bottom. And the window at the bottom goes out 6.5 inches. That's what we found when the investigation was done the morning of his accident. And Milko comes in and says, oh yes, this cube and channel stop that we put in the top, that's got to go down in the sill in the bottom. And that's where that window moved the 6.5 inches that allowed Mr. Janke to escape and violated the design specification of a 5-inch opening. And somehow that has gotten lost throughout this whole process. And I think the second element for immunity, the product has to meet the design, is completely lacking.
Well, the first one is the United States, and this would be the state here, Clark County, approved reasonably precise specifications. Did you approve reasonably precise specifications of the window?
In limited terms, no window that opened, no bars, no screens, and there was also a directive that we didn't want to spend the money on air conditioning.
All right, and 5 inches.
No. Well, that comes from Pamela Green and Abramson.
Okay, so you didn't want a window that they could open and get out.
Right, and that's a Hamill, Green, and Abramson decision, whether it's 3, 4, 5, 6 inches.
Right, and are you responsible for their precise specifications, Clark County?
To the extent that it's just a rubber stamp approval, I think the Trevino case and the Boyle case both stand for the proposition that absent an active involvement on the part of the government, a participation in the process, an involvement in the decision, it's not an immune situation. Otherwise, every contract with the government would be immune.
Yeah, well, I'm getting to that. How do we know the difference between a rubber stamp and a thoughtful, intelligent decision? I mean, if you put your stamp on it, how do we know that?
Well, I think that becomes a factual investigation in every case. Even in the Lyons case, they had to look at some letters that went back and forth between the DOT and the engineer, And they said, the only reasonable inference we can draw is that DOT made the decision for the height and coverage.
So you don't think this case fits under the first ground of United States approved, reasonably precise specifications, or state approved?
Other than those few items that I listed.
Right. That's not reasonably precise for the purposes of this window. Is that your position?
Right, once you get outside that area.
Okay, and then the equipment conformed to those specs. Well, since there were no specs, it couldn't have conformed.
There was the 5-inch spec that Hamel, Green, and Abramson wrote. But the bottom of the window opened 6.5 inches.
But should the architect be responsible for its specs?
It depends upon the nature of the contract. Many architects try to bow out of that responsibility by just saying we observe conditions of construction. In this case, Larry Stenz was there from Hamel, Green, and Abramson to see that that contract was performed, that his specifications met, as my understanding.
So that's why you think they should be liable?
They'll be still again in the case with
Pardon
us.
Pardon me?
Still in the case with us, yes.
And the third one is the supplier warned the state about the dangers and the use of the equipment that were known to the supplier but not to the state. Were you warned?
No. And I think where the Court of Appeals got a little confused is they kind of ran the second and third elements together, and nobody knew that this window opened 6.5 inches on the bottom. And I think just because Milco didn't know and we didn't figure out that was going on until after the accident, that should create immunity for Milco. They never met the contract to begin with.
Let me ask you, you were warned in the sense that, let's say, 1984, this started and you had an incident where someone was able to get out or attempt an escape. But then you had another incident, I believe, in 87, where there was another situation similar. So you knew that something had to be done, and you came in with, I guess you call them the channel stops at that time, the 15.5-inch channel stops. So what about that as far as the...
The 84 incident is the cube stop below
the
window.
Right.
And the window bangs up against it, the cube stop comes out, and now it goes the whole
point.
So we went to the people involved and said, you got to change it. The channel stop then is locked in behind the cube stop, and that is securely in there. So now even if the cube stop comes out, you get one more inch, which Janky did get. In that situation, there was a watchmaker who was actually able to fashion a tool in a secure room and get out the fancy little screw that held the channel in and drop it down.
Yeah.
That situation has not occurred here. But what nobody figured out in either of those two incidents is that the stop at the top didn't work, that you also needed the stop at the bottom. And that, I think, is the significant difference.
Why should the government contractor be liable, the MU? You know, they build the building, why shouldn't they have the same liability that they would have if they built the building for me or some other private entity?
I think in most cases that could well be true, but it's when the government steps in and exercises its discretion and makes directives and said, you know, you will build this building upside down, if you will. You know, at that point, the contractor should just do what they're told.
Is it your view that the contractor is liable except that where the contractor has the claim, the government made me do it. I was under orders.
I think that's correct.
So that's the only time. So if you say build me a building 6 stories high, I want it to be secure, but I want it to look as if it's a home setting, and I leave it to you all to figure out how to do that, then you think they should be liable.
Right, you just like contracting with you for your house.
So why isn't this kind of case? Your position is it is this kind of case.
Because Arlen Mills, in his expertise as an administrator of a healthcare facility, says, I don't want those bars, I don't want those screens, I want a window that opens. I think those things, if somebody were to criticize that, and I believe the plaintiff's expert did, should be immune, and HGA shouldn't have to answer for that. That's the government's decision.
But there's a charge against you under the Safe Place statute.
Yes, and there's a case that came down in 1997, Spencer versus Brown County, 215 West 2nd, 635, at page 645 and 646, which says the Safe Place duty does not create a ministerial duty, i.e. it's a discretionary function, and they created immunity where a prisoner slipped and fell in a jail for design, equipment, and maintenance of the shower facility. So I think when we have to revisit that issue, if we do, that will take the Safe Place issue out of the case for the county as a discretionary.
What about the contributory negligence issue?
I don't think the law should change on that. I think the Court of Appeals is trying to say if you're a plaintiff, we'll treat you one way, and if you're a defendant, we'll treat you another. I think it creates an impossible situation in terms of, well, let's say Mr. Janke goes out the window and he lands on somebody like that guy dove out of the stands at a baseball game and landed on a baseball player. Going out the window, he's immune under the appeals theory, but when he hits the ground and injures somebody else, he's liable. What if Janke and another patient injure each other? They're not liable for their own negligence, but the other guy owes them for their negligence. Then it's a question of who hurt the other one the worst to see who makes out. You just get into a spiral here. I think if you're a plaintiff defendant or maybe even a third-party plaintiff.
I'd like to give another example. The plaintiff not only got out, but he went on the loose for a week, and he's walking down the road, and he has an accident there. In other words, would you think that they would initially come back to Clark County or to on the contributory negligence? My concern is just where do you cut it off? What is the stopping point in that area?
And that's why I don't think we can use the standard that has come down from the Court of Appeals. I've had the case where the guy got out the window, did it safely, and in one case went in the river and then drowned, and in another case ran out the road and got hit by a truck. You know, how does this changing standard of care fit those situations? It isn't going to work. An important part, I think, about Janke, too, is that he is not severely mentally disabled. When he's on his lithium, he's doing okay. He went off of it. He's back on it for about 12 days. And he comes up with a pretty specific plan to deceive the county, to make his escape, to do it in a safe fashion, so far as to save the cube stop, because he was going to come back in the employee entrance the next day and go back in and put the cube stop back.
Counsel, how long was he in the institution?
I heard 12 days.
I thought 12 days.
I know on July 21st he was taken off the 15-minute watch, and this was July 29th, so I know 8 days, and I was looking through the record with that thought in mind, and I really don't find his admission date, and so I stuck to the record, but it's a minimum of 8 days, and it might be a couple days longer. In fact, it probably is. But he's on his meds for the 8 days, and then puts this plan together. When we look at the criteria for determining whether or not public policy should cut off responsibility, the third element is, would a defendant feign a mental illness to avoid civil liability? I think we've got to flip that around here and say, would a plaintiff feign mental illness to create liability? I think that's the policy considerations we looked at here. The Court of Appeals said, well, he's never going to go into an institution to avoid future liability, and I would agree with that. The focus should be not on his condition when he comes in, but what he's doing when he leaves the institution and what public policy is at work there. Now he is injured. Isn't it a thought that he could feign mental illness and make this claim? At page 113 of Hamill, Green, and Abramson's appendix is noted that Mrs. Janke called there at 6:30 in the morning, a half an hour after he was found, and said, "Is Emil there?" He's in a locked facility. She was with him the night before at 10:30, and she doesn't call and say, "I want to talk to him. How is his health?" It's, "Is he there?" Our argument for the trial court is being played out here for the plaintiff's attorney, but I think she was part of the plan to pick him up. Clark County is way out in the middle of nowhere. He's not going anywhere unless he's going to walk for a long distance. Okay. I think this was a plan after the fact to say, hey, I was in a mental institution, let's take advantage of it. I'm insane, don't hold me responsible. I think that policy element causes a problem in this case.
Would you be making the first argument here if you had prevailed in the Court of Appeals on the second argument?
I'm sorry, I lost first and second.
If you had prevailed on the contributory negligence argument in the Court of Appeals, would you have been here arguing about the governmental immunity applied to the contractors?
Well, I guess we probably would be out of the case. I think oftentimes courts rule as a matter of law, like it's more negligent, but they don't have to. I mean, they might just hold them to that standard and say we still need a jury trial. And in that situation,
I mean, the bottom line is, Should Clark County walk out of this scot-free, but should Mr. Janke collect from these other defendants?
Well, we still have exposure for negligent supervision by our health care professionals that night, so that this is not going to be, I think, necessarily outcome determinative as far as the contractor issues. I mean, we could still all end up together in the case facing little different issues.
Thank you, Mr. Minkowski. We now will turn to Attorney Timothy Murphy. He represents the Hamel Green and Abrahamson and the Continental Casualty. Just to make it clear, as far as I know, Mr. or Ms. Abrahamson, the architect, is no relation to me or my husband. If he or she claims otherwise, I'll make the decision as to how wealthy they are and if they have any other heirs.
So noted, Your Honor. If it please the court, counsel Tim Murphy, representing the architects Hamel Green and Abrahamson, or as their reference for short in this case, HGA, as well as Continental Casualty. Obviously, in the short time allotted, we have to rely heavily on our briefs and the factual record, and I will do so. We're here to argue the governmental contractor defense adopted by the Lyons Court should be the law of Wisconsin, and that the Court of Appeals opinion in this case should be affirmed with respect to both HGA and its subcontractors.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. You're from Minnesota, and you do have a number on your brief. Are you admitted in this state?
I am, Your Honor.
That's what I thought. Okay, thank you. Just to clarify, you do have a number here.
Five key areas from the facts I believe are relevant to all the questions that the court has asked earlier this morning, and I won't dwell on any of them. Highlighting them, one, security screens, no question that the state of Wisconsin, through its statutes and administrative officials and the inspection process, ruled that those could not be applied in this refurbishing of this building. There's citations and appendix for use of security screens. This ward was a three-level system that's been ignored in the arguments that the court has heard thus far. Clearly, there was a seclusion room with no windows, an isolation room with an unbreakable window, and finally, the patient room, which is the one at issue in this case, which Administrator Mills, who was entrusted by the state of Wisconsin and its licensing agencies with the professional authority to govern the location of patients that are committed to his care, the lowest level of security, his uncontroverted record being, we want operable windows, no security screens, we want insect screens, we want a normalized environment as possible. This is our last level of contact with this patient in a locked ward before they either go back out on the street, back to their family, or back to other locked units, unlocked units within the ward. Clearly, the ward and the professional discretion of the administrator has to be evaluated in light of the three levels of security. Additional facts, HGA has a contract, very extensive contract here. The old adage, a deal is a deal. No one has addressed those issues except for HGA in its brief. Clearly, the county reserved the right to approve each and every specification after it was drafted, and they indicated clearly that HGA was to act only in accordance with the county's directives. Contract law, students of that discipline would clearly say there is no question under contract law that the specifications were adopted. The county to now say that they had no part in that, I believe, is not well-founded. Additionally, factually, the record is clear that HGA had no control over Mr. Janke when he was in that ward, no control over the days that they had him spend in the other levels of security, the seclusion or isolation room. No decision on HGA's part as to when Mr. Minkowski's client would move him from a 15-minute watch down to a 60-minute watch or an overnight watch. Those are all professional decisions. The expert opinions from the plaintiff's side distilled down, as the Court of Appeals recognized, are clearly that the architects were being criticized for selecting operable windows in the abstract, and or if the client would not accept operable windows, if the client would not accept non-operable windows, that an insistence by the architect should have taken place that there be security screens. Clearly, as the Court of Appeals recognized, uncontroverted testimony from Mr. Mills, a professional licensed by the state, I want operable windows, I would have rejected security screens in an instant, I want the therapeutic benefit of a breeze blowing in these rooms and a normalized environment for these patients who are going to be back on the street or in a non-locked ward.
Yeah, but another window could have done everything. It could have given them the breeze, it could have given them security, and that could have prevented them slipping out, I assume.
Your Honor, if I can answer that question by just addressing the policy behind the discretionary immunity under the 893-80 statutes subsection that we're dealing with here is to prevent lawyers, courts, from second-guessing decisions of the policymakers who decide that this package is the window that they want for that patient room to provide the therapeutic benefit for these patients that move through this ward.
Your immunity depends on the government immunity, doesn't it? I mean, if the government isn't immune for a decision, you won't be immune.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And we so argued in our briefs as to why the Lyons Court recognize the injustice that if the county, Mr. Minkowski's clients, had employed architects with the same degrees and the same stripes on their sleeve as work at HGA in their county architectural department, they had made these exact decisions. In my opinion, Your Honor, as I've argued in the brief, there's no question they would be held immune for this decision. To address the court's question earlier on the safe place statute, I think Mr. Minkowski answered that. I believe they have a good argument under that. It wasn't for us to make that for them. The subsequent case law has apparently decided that discretionary immunity can apply to that. I believe Mr. Minkowski would make that argument if this case were ever to proceed back to the trial court. But in the same token, it would be an injustice to say that architects employed by the county would be immune for this, and the general or the private sector independent contractor should not. And I believe that.
But the architects who work for the county are under the county's control. They're even if they're not supervised at every turn, the county is liable for them as agents, and if they're discretionary decisions, then the county's not going to be liable. But suppose I'm the county and I just ask you to build generally a building, six stories, give you some general outlines, give you a price, and then say, go to it, right? Should you be immune for every decision that you make?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that the Lyons test addresses that issue exactly. Did the county, did the governmental agency approve reasonably precise specifications? Assuming you give me that directive to send me off on my mission, I come back knowing how the professional product gets prepared. There is a design development phase, specifications are arrived at, there's a price determined. The county or the agency always, in the real world, signs off on these specifications to the nth degree of detail before they can be a shovel can be lifted to start the process. So the Lyons test addresses that. I believe that the answer to that question is in step number one. Did the government agency approve reasonably precise specifications?
And even if they rubber stamped it, they had the authority to approve it, and that's tough luck on them, right?
Well, you know, the rubber stamp issue, Your Honor, it kind of caused me to raise an eyebrow because all I can answer as far as an architect is we do not have any decision-making power over an institutionalized patient in a psychiatric ward in the state of Wisconsin. We take a design decision, a design directive that's made. We come up with a window package, a three-level security system, and the state of Wisconsin, with the county officials that are given that authority by the state, sign off on those specifications. And then later, after they've had hundreds of patients go through that ward, successfully treating them therapeutically with this three-level system, then when there's a one-time issue where a patient exercises a risk and escapes, all of a sudden it's a question that they simply rubber stamp these directives and they're untrained in analysis of these issues. And so if that answers Your Honor's question, I believe that the common sense speaks for itself on that.
Counsel, but in this case, there had been at least two prior attempts to escape, which HGA was familiar with. And you were asked asked, I believe, if I hope that my facts correct, that you should take a look at that and come up with some redesign. Correct?
Correct, Your Honor. There was an incident during construction where the cube stop was pried loose by a patient. Mr. Mills asked for redesign. That's when the channel stops were arrived at. They were installed during the completion of construction. And subsequently, in 1987, the German watchmaker patient that's been referred to was able to, with superior mechanical skills, unscrew the channel stop from the head of the window. And at that time, and I think the way the Court of Appeals dealt with this, which I believe was astute on their part, was they basically took the fact that Mr. Mills was aware from the incident during construction that the cube stops could be pried loose, so he was aware of that. Secondly, he was aware from the 87 elopement, successfully elopement attempt, that the channel stops could be defeated by superior skills. Looking at all that and looking at the risk-benefit analysis, decided not to make any changes at all in the system. 2 years later, Mr. Yonke elopes by, with no controversy in this case, by removing, prying loose the cube stop, the same thing that had happened back during construction.
With a toothbrush.
Correct. And whether it was a surgical steel instrument or a toothbrush, the fact is, Arlen Mills, a professional licensed by the state to make these decisions, decided to continue to use the cube stop in its application in the head of the window. And knowing, as he admitted, that any time you introduce this therapeutic benefit of having a window and sash on the device, you're going to have a risk of elopement. So I think the Court of Appeals said, even with these additional knowledge on Mr. Mills' part, the cube stop removal, the channel stop being unscrewed, et cetera, that those essentially by the county are approval of reasonable specifications almost after the construction phase, which retroactively goes back under Lyons and Boyle to the county or to the independent contractor's immunity decisions. And again, Your Honor, I see my lights on, but the one other point I would like to make to the court, give me a moment, is just that I think what gets lost here is negligence is not a concept that is an issue in an immunity decision. The arguments that we've heard largely are that the HGA was negligent in making various decisions with respect to the system or how it would work. That is not what immunity is based on, and would ask the court to keep that in mind and affirm the Court of Appeals in all respects on immunity.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Attorney Luck, representing J.P. Cullen.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please, the court. My name is Wayne Luck. I'm representing J.P. Cullen & Sons and Wausau Underwriters Insurance Company. J.P. Cullen is the contractor, the general contractor in this case. I'd like to begin with the reasonable person standard because it appears that the plaintiff is asking the Supreme Court to overrule itself in Gould and adopt the Court of Appeals finding in Gould, and that is to create this nebulous, moving, reasonable person standard. This court overruled that in Gould before the Supreme Court, indicating that it would create a nightmare for the court to attempt to create a flexible standard as far as what is a reasonable person. Would effectively have several hundred million reasonable person standards in this country. What my reading of the case law indicates that there is one exception to the reasonable person standard, and that was in Brunick. Brunick created the exception for the sudden mental disability, and that was a case where Irma Veith was driving down the highway and suddenly had hallucinations, or claimed that they were suddenly hallucinations, but the record showed that she'd had this type of thing in the past. So the court refused to apply it to her, but they created that exception. In Gould, this court found that the reasonable standard person did apply, and it was applied to Gould, but for other policy considerations, the court refused to hold Gould liable. So to create a standard for the future that a reasonable person, because of a mental disability, will be a different standard, we'd have to analyze every plaintiff to find out what their mental capacity is, and every defendant to find out what their mental capacity is before we go forward on the case.
How would we know exactly the mental capacity of Mr. Yonke if we were to say, in this case, that we just use the record? Do you think this case, this court can make that decision as a matter of law, or should we send it back to a jury to take a look?
I think this court can make that decision.
And why?
I think it's a question of law. Based on the history of the case law that I've read, the only exception to the reasonable person standard is Brunig. And I believe it's a question of law for the court to decide whether a person is able to stand trial.
You don't see Gould as an exception?
I don't.
To the reasonable person standard?
No, I don't. I see Gould as applying the reasonable person standard, but then taking the next step that because of the circumstances, because we have a caregiver with a patient, public policy considerations stepped in and said, we're not going to hold him liable.
Sounds like an exception to me. Maybe it's largely semantics.
It's a game of semantics, I guess.
Gould was an Alzheimer's case where there was a substantial history, a medical history, that the court was able to know about what was happening to this individual. Isn't that the case here, where this person has a lengthy mental disability?
No, Your Honor. I believe Birch and Gould, we both dealt with, in both cases, we dealt with people that had no control. Amy Birch and Mr. Monikin and Gould were both long-time, permanently disabled people. Amy Birch from birth, Mr. Monikin had Alzheimer's, and those were uncontrollable. I look at Mr. Janke as somewhat in the same vein as I would as a chronic alcoholic. A chronic alcoholic can control his future, can control what he's doing. If he opens a bottle and takes a sip, he knows there may be no end. He knows that going in. Mr. Janke knew that if he went off of the lithium, he was going to have problems. In fact, it had happened on several occasions before where he had gone off the lithium, had problems, and the medical testimony and Mr. Subbu, their expert, testified that he would have known, he knew that it would be dangerous to go off of the lithium. And in this case, he beat up his wife and was finally locked up. But from, when you look at the record on what Mr. Janke was able to accomplish after he was back on his medication with regard to setting up the bed, making it look like he was there, getting this master scheme together on his escape, I don't think it's fair at all to put him in the same light as Mr. Monikin in the Gould case or as Amy Birch. I believe it's more in the vein of Mrs. Veith, but in Brunig, but I believe even Mrs. Veith was closer to firmly. Mr. Janke. Mr. Janke could control the situation. His history shows us that.
Counsel, I note that in your brief, you don't even think this is an issue that can be raised on you, and that the circuit court judgment or the circuit court decision is final as to you because the Janke and Clark County didn't raise this as an issue against you.
Correct, Your Honor. When this case was appealed to the Court of Appeals, it was appealed on both issues, and the Court of Appeals addressed the reasonable person standard only as to Clark County, which was the health care provider. In fact, my position is that there was never anything wrong with this window or the room. They simply put the wrong person in the wrong room. If the person who put Mr. Janke in the room that night could do some Monday morning quarterbacking, they would say he didn't belong there because he was a risk. But the Court of Appeals never compared the negligence of Mr. Janke to the contractors and the architect.
So your position then is on a governmental immunity, your issue.
Correct. And,
you just spent 10 minutes arguing another issue.
That's why I'm asking you this.
It's covering my bases, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
It's
covering your bases.
Covering my bases, Your Honor. Because it's unclear what the Court of Appeals was ruling on, but when you look at what their decision was, it only applied to Clark County.
And when you look at the petition for review. Okay.
You are asking us, as I understand it, to maybe, let's see, Mr. Watford. If you prevail on your first argument, the first 5 minutes, you don't have to address the contractor issue, right?
Correct.
You say that Mr. Yonke, as a matter of law, was more negligent.
That is correct.
And so what's this about waiving that issue? I don't understand that.
The Court of Appeals did
You don't want to waive that issue, do you?
I win either way. If it's waived, the judgment stands.
Oh, I see. You're saying that Mr. Yonke waived the issue.
That's right.
As
correct.
With respect to you.
Right.
So it's a win-win for me.
Right.
If I could just, my time's running, could I just address the Lyons issues briefly? With regard to the contractor immunity issues, before Cullen ever got involved in this case, there was a meeting that went on between Clark County and HTA to determine what type of building they wanted, and all the plans and specs were put together, and ultimately it was sent out for bids. Cullen bid on the project and got the project. In those plans and specifications, the plans called for a Milco window. It not only called for the manufacturer, but it also called for a specific model, the W21T window, which was the sliding window. We briefly got into the reasons why the county wanted that window. It was basically that they wanted windows that were open with sliding operable sashes and no security screens. They were looking for the environmental setting. They also had a number of policy considerations that were discussed between HGA and Clark County. Clark County today has taken the position that we knew nothing about how to build a hospital. We knew nothing. We had no input. But they had a number of policy considerations that they looked at, including their budget, which was primary. They looked at correction of past code violations, the therapeutic environment. They had a number of reasons for wanting that specific windows. But the point is, by the time it got to Cullen and to the window manufacturer, to Milco, the contract already called for that specific window. We had no discretion, no input into this decision-making process. We had a contractual duty to provide that window. The plaintiff would like to have had us come step forward and say, no, we're not going to put that window in. We're going to put in a window that doesn't open, but we would have been sued for breach of contract. But taking the next step, when you look at the Lyons test, the three-pronged test, which was adopted from Boyle, the first part of the test is, were the governmental specifications reasonably precise? I believe when the specifications tell us that we want this specific model and make a window, that's reasonably precise. With regard to whether our actions conform to the specifications, we subcontracted with Milco to not only supply the window, but put the window in and install it. The third issue with regard to warning the governmental entity of any possible dangers, Cullen knew of no dangers. Along the way, there was a danger discovered by Clark County that the cube stop could be removed if the person had the knowledge and the ability to remove it. But we knew of no dangers. And the Oliver versus Oshkosh truck case, we find that it's not necessary to search out dangers, but if we know of a danger, we have to bring it to their attention. Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Walker? Well, thank you, Counsel. Attorney John Ritchie, representing Warsaw Metals Corporation and Mr. Schur.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. My name is John Ritchie. From Eau Claire. I represent Milco Company, the Wausau Metals Corporation, St. Paul Fire and Marine. There's always a disadvantage of going last because probably you plan to argue your arguments has been torn up by the time you get this far. But I'd like to go through a couple of the things that I had planned to talk about. I'd like to start with the immunity issue because I think that's a case that this court can get rid of this case for everybody. When we talk about the immunity issue and how it applies, it starts with our common law, all starts with Brunig. Everybody is held accountable for their own conduct, and that comes with Brunig saying if we're going to talk about mental illness, it's just like a physical illness. If you can prove that your mental illness came on suddenly and with no forewarning, well, in that situation, you're not going to be negligent. That's not the case that we have here. Okay, just like we didn't have it in Brunig, we don't have it here because we have a historical repeat of problems with that. When we move beyond Brunig, then the court has always held, if Brunig doesn't apply, then the mentally disabled person is going to be held to the reasonable man standard. Brunig was held to the reasonable man standard, even though she had hallucinations. Amy Birch, a mentally retarded 15-year-old girl, was held to the reasonable man standard. She won that case. The jury found her not negligent, but she was still held to the reasonable man standard. And then we get to Gould, who was the Alzheimer's patient who attacked the caretaker. Mr. Monikin, that Alzheimer's patient, was also held to the reasonable man standard, and he was found negligent. But in that case, they came to this court, and this court said, you know, it's an unusual set of circumstances when we're dealing with someone who has permanent disabilities, who's institutionalized, and he injures the very people that are hired to take care of him. You know, that separates him from Amy Birch, the 15-year-old girl who's mentally retarded. It may seem unfair to hold anybody who's mentally disabled accountable for their conduct, but Amy Birch was held accountable. So was Ms. Byth, the driver, with delusions. So why do we get a different result when we're talking about the Alzheimer's patient? Well, in that case, we're dealing with somebody, first of all, he's got a permanent disability. He's innocent. He didn't cause that. That's something that he couldn't stop, he couldn't prevent, and he's in a hospital where they're paid to take care of that specific illness. That's where you can say, you know, the public policies in that case seem to go with him. In this case, however, we've got somebody who is told, you have a mental illness and it is going to cause dangers to you and to everybody else if you don't take your medicine. Take your medicine every day. Mr. Janke had the decision to say, well, I can take my medicine and stay safe, or to hell with it, I'm not going to take my medicine, and when I flip out and I have a relapse, don't blame me because I'm going to argue that I'm incapacitated. Well, you know what? We need an incentive to say, Mr. Janke, you will stay on your medicine, and if you have the information, the ability, and the capacity to avoid these relapses, then you have the responsibility to do that. And if you don't, then we're going to hold you accountable for what happens when you do relapse. It's akin to somebody who is perhaps taking drugs like a hallucinogenic drug. That person can't take the drug and then come in and say, don't blame me for what I do when I'm having a bad LSD trip. We say, yeah, we will blame you for what you do. If you go to the hospital and the doctors are trying to start arterial lines and that person rips it out and rips his artery in the process, he could sue the doctor for malpractice, but the doctor should be able to say, that's unreasonable for you to be ripping out the arterial lines, and don't try and get off by saying you chose to take drugs or you chose, in this case, to not take your drugs. In either event, if you are temporarily mentally disabled through your own choices, then I think public policy speaks that that person should be held accountable.
But the doctors would know, or should know, that that this patient is subject to not taking the drugs, that will relapse, and therefore, or take pull the IV out of his veins or arteries, or that the doctor has to take precautions.
The doctor would be sued in malpractice. On the other hand, the patient should not get off scot-free for his conduct, because his actions in doing that are not innocent, like they might be for Mr. Monikin, who didn't cause his own illness. In this case,
somebody, I was going to use an epileptic seizure, but that would not be the same. But if somebody is drunk, and therefore will do things that are not for their own good, and is hospitalized, I assume that the healthcare providers have to take that into account. So you might strap that guy down. If they don't strap him down and he falls out of bed, they may very well be liable, even though the person who overindulged caused unreasonable risk of harm to him.
Well, and that's where I think there could be a difference drawn when you'd say that there is somebody who is an innocent patient, like the Alzheimer's patient, versus somebody who is not an innocent patient.
Like,
and I think my
drunk driver in the hospital?
Yes. And you also get into the issue of if the litigants are only a patient versus a healthcare provider, that may be one thing, because you're talking about somebody who is paid with specialized care to take care of that individual. But now you're expanding it potentially to other litigants who are not the hired caretakers, which is the architects and the contractors. That moves us. We've got both. On one hand, in the claim against Clark County, we've got the Birch decision, the Gould decision. On the other hand, if you take it against everybody else, that's the Brunig decision. How do we say that in this case you're accountable for your conduct, in this case you're not? And I think it's best public policy to say, well, Mr. Monikin was relieved because he had that innocence of not bringing on his own problem. And in this case, he did.
Mr. Ritchie, do you believe we should send this back for further jury consideration on one or two issues, one issue being his medical incapacity, the second issue being contributory negligence?
No, because there should never be an issue as to what his mental capacity is, because you should be held to the reasonable man standard regardless.
Well, in Gould, we didn't do that, did we? Because he had Alzheimer's and clearly didn't know what he was doing. I mean, so this court could decide that, well, you know, maybe we want to carve out another Gould exception for a plaintiff who doesn't know what he's doing.
Well, that's right. If you're going to make that exception, okay, then you would have that problem.
Then it would have to go back, which is what the Court of Appeals did.
Right. That's... The court has kind of done it in reverse, but that's what the Court of Appeals did.
Okay, but what about the question then of contributory negligence?
I don't think that could be any different than straight negligence.
Well, when do you think as a matter of law we should hold him more contributory negligent than the cumulative defendant?
If he's held to the reasonable man standard, yes. That's what the trial court did. And I don't think that there's any problem with the trial court's finding in that.
Your opposing counsel raised a question of fact, perhaps. And that is, his comment was, look, this is 6.5 inches, not 5 inches, and this has been lost in the whole discussion. If that's true, and I'm just playing that out, if that's true, that might be reprehensible. You know, I don't know. That might be negligent.
I'm ready. I know exactly where you're going.
Okay.
I can tell you what you're...
Then answer the question.
Okay. Here's the deal. Is that when you look at this, you have to look at the reasonably precise specifications that we're talking about, and you have to look at what the criticisms are that are being leveled against the defendants in this case. The county said, okay, of all the windows in the world that you have to pick from, I have a couple criteria that have to apply to all of them. Number one, the windows must open. Mm-hmm. I do not want fixed windows. Okay, what's the first criticism that's leveled against these windows? You have a Milco 21T window. It's been around for yet forever. What's the problem? The expert says you shouldn't have windows that open. Well, you can't make that criticism because that walks directly into the one design criteria. We had fixed windows in other rooms. We could have put them in the whole hospital if you wanted us to. But they said we want openable windows. So you can't criticize that. Okay, what's the next criteria they said? We do not want bars or security screens. Milco can't go out there and put up security screens. So what is the next criticism? Well, if you're going to have windows that open, then put bars or security screens over them. We can't do that. The county gave those directions. So what is the next criticism? There are really no other criticisms. The 3 inches, 5 inches, 7 inches, when we asked plaintiff's expert about that, well, how wide is too wide? He said, I don't have any opinion about that. I'm not saying 5 inches is too wide or 7 inches is too wide. But what's gotten lost even further in all of this is that when that patient first escaped back in 1984, they went to the architect to say, hey, what can you do? Went to Cullen, said, what can you do? Came back to Milko, said, what can you do? Oh, well, under that scenario, we recommend that you don't use the cube stop to limit how far the window opens. We're going to put a 15.5-inch channel stop up there. The window's going to only open 3 inches. And we put it in writing and sent it to them, said, here's what we recommend. If you want us to do it, give us 10 days and we'll be done. They came back and said, do it. We did it. The window's open 3 inches. Even plaintiff's expert says you can't get out of 3 inches. So if you want to talk about what is the responsibility of the manufacturer, what are we supposed to do? We gave them what they wanted. when they asked our opinion on what to do, we said we recommend making it a permanent channel stop, and we recommend a smaller opening. They say, okay. Later on, somebody decides they want to change it and cut them off and start jerry-rigging things to something that's different from what we left, and then they want to blame us because the windows open too wide. So I don't think it's our responsibility, and this how wide does it open, nobody has been critical of how wide it opens because he has there is no opinion that 5 inches is okay and 6 inches isn't.
Thank you, counsel. In rebuttal, we will get 2.5 minutes for Mr. Hayes and 2.5 minutes for Mr. Kowski. Speak fast.
That's the truth. In rebuttal, I will say on the reasonable person standard, what we are asking for is that the mental status of Mr. Janke be a question of fact to be considered by the jury at the time that they evaluate the negligence in these parties, or of these parties. It's also important to note that he was on his medication at the time. Mr. Janke was in the hospital, incarcerated against his will, taking his medication at this time. On the waiver issue, I'll speak just briefly. There are many decisions in this where this court can consider issues that were not considered by the Court of Appeals. At the time, the Court of Appeals handled the waiver issue was after the immunity issue had been decided and the defendants were already out on those issues. So I don't think anything has been waived by the form of the petitions for review. Use of these windows after the knowledge of the stop does not constitute approval of this specification or of this product. There are cases under the Boyle line of cases where the government continued to use products. If you believe or if you hold that constitutes an approval, it puts the government in a very difficult position. If there's a defective product and the government continues to use it, they've granted immunity to the very party that supplied them with a defective product. On the other hand, if they have knowledge, they have this knowledge of the defective product, they then must go out and spend all of the money that's necessary to repair these products, whether it's cables under an F-16 fighter jet, or whether it's doors under a helicopter, or whether it stops on a window. That goes against the very principle of immunity, which is to preserve the government funds. Finally, it is not necessary for this court to adopt the Lyons and Boyle line of cases in order to preserve governmental immunity. We are asking the court to accept the strict construction interpretation of 89380, which has been the law of this state, and as outlined in Lyons, where governmental immunity is only granted where there is a master-servant relationship. Adopting the Boyle test through the Lyons case removes the element of control of the subcontractor from the government and grants that contractor immunity. Thank you.
May I ask a question? Mr. Minkowski made some reference to the record of a call that Mrs. Janke made at 6:30 in the morning or something. What is that all about?
Well, she called the hospital. Mr. Janke had been hospitalized there for some time. Mr. Minkowski's putting a lot of significance on, you know, is he there? Well, to me, that's how 95% of the phone calls are received. You say, is someone there, when you're not talking to that person. So the significance of that, I suppose, could be left to a jury at some point in time. Whether that's part of a big conspiracy, of course, I certainly would disagree. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Minkowski.
2 points. I'd like to go back and visit window reconstruction and also whether this is a court or jury issue on Mr. Jenkins' favorite here. The cube stop in the top window at the time of the accident is there. The next one is the channel stop. That window opens 4 inches at the top. The cube comes out, it now opens 5. The appellant's appendix, page 112 and 113, shows that. It's at the bottom where there's no stops, and it goes 6.5. So taking the cube stop out gets it back to the 5-inch specification is really what that accomplishes. Mr. Ritchie was asked to address the 6.5-inch opening at the bottom. He didn't get an answer. It's been the same way through all this court process. They can't get away from it. It's 6.5 inches at the bottom, and it isn't meeting the specification. Plaintiff's expert says ventilation is too small for the 5-inch opening. He has now created more ventilation problems. That had to be opened up because those were getting warm in the summer. So to say you fixed one problem and created another, I think, is somewhat meaningless. An important one to me is this consideration of remanding this to the trial court. I don't think you can ever have a jury answer the question that the Court of Appeals would like them to answer in this decision. If the jury has to decide after an accident, a severe injury, if a person had the capacity to appreciate the risk they were taking, in any case, the jury's going to say no. Anybody who sticks their hand in a machine and gets it chopped off, is badly burned, any jury after the fact is going to say, well, obviously that person didn't appreciate the risk that they were taking. They didn't have the capacity to understand how silly or stupid this was.
So what kind of question do you expect to go back?
I think it should be a question of law to be answered by the trial judge.
And what's the question to be answered?
Well, I guess I hope we never get to that stage. I mean, that's sort of a fallback position for me. I hope we stay with the reasonable standard of care. But I think the standard laid out in the Court of Appeals decision in Janke, that is the question they would send to the jury, should really be sent to the trial judge.
You want us to affirm the trial?
In terms of saying we held him to a reasonable standard of care and he is more negligent as a matter of law, yes. But I just have a fear that if this were ever to go back to a jury, when we read the Gould decision, the court itself is wrestling with how can we determine the difference between a mental defect and just variations of human nature, intellect, emotions, and such. The court itself couldn't draw that line and stayed with the concept of we're just not going to change the standard. Everybody's going to be held to a reasonable standard. So if the court can't find that moving target, no juror looking at some kind of horrible injury after the fact ever can be expected to do that. It just has to be done as a matter of law.
I tell you what's bothering me. You're dealing with somebody who is institutionalized, an involuntary commitment because the person's a danger to themselves or to someone else. And they come to the Clark County facility. Clark County facility knows why they're there. They're a danger to themselves. The obligation of the Clark County facility is to protect this person against himself and protect this person, protect others against him. And if that's the obligation. And what the Clark County, I mean, this is the allegation, the Clark County facility has done is put this person who is a danger to himself, going to do something that reasonable people don't do because they're not going to be there, right, in the facility. But there are reasonable people as to their own health. That's the standard. So now they're in there. You're supposed to be protecting them, and you put them in a room where they can get out, and they are dangerous to themselves. And so then you say, hey, I'm not liable because they're more negligent than I am because they're dangerous to themselves and he does something that is dangerous to himself. I mean, that doesn't make sense to me.
Well,
it makes sense to me if somebody who was in a hotel and the hotel window opened wider than 5 inches and somebody could get out and step onto a balcony. You know, many hotels don't allow that anymore. And then you say, hey, I'm perfectly reasonable person. I paid for the hotel. I don't have any problems. I step out to the balcony and step down 2 stories. I'm more negligent than the hotel is by definition, by a matter of law. But how can you apply that standard under these circumstances?
Well,
I'll be checked into a hotel. I think you might say that the hotel is not liable because he's more negligent, but it's not a hotel.
Well, presumably when these people are released, they are normal people that can account for their
own. But he's not released.
But he's getting close to that stage, and we're dealing with the transition of 12 days coming in bad shape with the meds getting better. So I think that is out there. And I'm not saying that Clark County should not be held responsible. I'm just saying that he has to have some responsibility, too. We would be an absolute guarantor of his safety if he could not be negligent. He could slip and fall on the floor, and we all... That's what I'm saying is that if we give him the wrong medication, he could have been the most uncontrollable person mentally in the world, and if he's held to a reasonable standard, it's still entirely the county's fault. I think you have to look at the particular facts that you're dealing with and not give absolute immunity to a resident.
The question I have is that if he does slip on the floor and there's wax, etc., obviously I think that under any standard, contributory negligence would say that Clark County is more liable more response to the fee. I think the issue that concerns me is where a person exhibits a thought process and then acts on that thought process. That's the question, whether we should make carve out an exception or deal with the reasonable demand standard. And answer that question here.
Well, I think that's right on point. He's got this thought process. He's got a plan. Saving the cube, putting the pillows in the bed, pulling the curtain around, going out the window that gets him down to a roof that he can stand on as opposed to the other window that just goes right down to the ground. Whether his wife was involved in this to pick him up, I guess we might debate. But there is a real method and a plan to what he is doing. I think then you take the fact that he's in an institution and he's badly injured, and if you're now going to ask a jury, did he appreciate the risk that he was undertaking, every time they're going to say no. And I've got one where a guy went off the roof of a concession stand, was covered with snow. Totally fine. The jury would answer that question the same way. No, he never appreciated the risk of falling off that snow-covered roof. So I think where the court wrestles with, we can't change the standard as a matter of law because it's a moving target, to put that burden on a jury is just something that can't possibly work.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our argument for this afternoon. We're in recess until 9:45 tomorrow morning.